One, it's great action, the thoughtfulness and appreciation. And it's good because then one doesn't become puffed up or overly confident in spiritual maturity. But low self-esteem deals more with a person in anxiety about what he or she can't do, doesn't have. It's kind of more self-centered. You know, it's lamenting, mainly based on, you know, the bodily platform, or the mental platform. But it's all still, the person is the center. So there's more of an embarrassment, or an anxiety, or a pain about what isn't happening, and then becoming paralyzed. You know, but
so what does someone do with low self-esteem to,
to realize that we may not be good at something, we may not have things the way we would like, but realizing that Krishna and the pure devotees, they can assist us, or they can use us, or they can help us, or they can empower us far beyond whatever our own limitations are. So that humility means, oh, I want to do this, I need to do this, I want to accomplish this, I want to be this, but I'm not so qualified. Because I'm not qualified, then I have to connect where there is power, where there is resource, where there is blessings. So this one inspires one to make connection, to be able to let what needs to happen happen. And we are low self-esteem. I can't do this, I can't do that, this won't work out, that won't work out, I'm useless, it's judo, it's fasting, so what should I even try? See, this is an area we have to also be more loving as we address it. There's a natural need for etiquette. And men and women shouldn't just mix whimsically, etc. Or they shouldn't deny the fact that there are different mentalities and physiognomy that's there. But now when it becomes exploitative, or when it is system that is there but not based on love, then it creates a casteism for chauvinism. And instead of protecting and empowering, it becomes abusive and exploitative. Well, the men should see the girls as their sisters and as a mother. Now, see, the difficulty is that so many of the men have a damn bad relationship with their mothers. And so when they even think of girls as mothers, so it makes it complex, you know. But in general, you know, a boy has a special relationship with his mother. He wants the best for his mother. He wants her to be protected. He wants her to be appreciated. So women should be considered, you know, like Lakshmi. That Lakshmi is something that's valuable. But also with Lakshmi, you don't just flaunt it around, right? You know, you have Lakshmi, you know, some people do, of course. But a intelligent, proper, spiritual, dominant person doesn't have to boast their Lakshmi, you know, they don't have to flap shoulder around. You know. Something that they kind of keep more, you know, secretly and securely, and is valuable. If it's valuable, then you keep it in a valuable way. So, the women should see the one in the middle. Where there's less lacking for exploitation, repulsion, excessive means of attraction. See, both things go on. It's part of the same kind of mindset. Excessive repulsion, excessive attraction. In Kali Yuga, there's less and less difference between men and women. But at the same time, when we minimize what is best for men, what is best for women, and then we minimize culture. There are some things that women do much more effectively than men. There's certain things that men do, in general, much more effectively, you know, than women. When they have a chance to do what they can do best, then it creates greater family, greater community. Now, because the whole society, you know, is so macho. And that's not only just those in the masculine bodies. There's a need for more feminine energy. So whether it's men or women, that men are more and more dominant, controlling, exploitive, sectarian. Women are developing more and more of this kind of masculine energy, minimizing the nurturing, minimizing the caretaking, the stewardship, and facilitation. In fact, some of the most materially successful women, in the process of becoming successful, have given up their femininity. Some of the most difficult persons you want to deal with is women judges, policemen, bank presidents. They'll give you hell. And it's not fully their fault because they have got so much hell to come to that position, right? They have worked hard. They have learned the game, how to manipulate, how to posture, how to be, duplicitous. And so they deal with you, depending with all of your anger and pain, but they have become to get that. It's important. And so everyone loses in that way. But it's important that even if a woman takes more responsibility in various areas, she doesn't give up that power. Power of femininity, the power of nourishing. So men need to develop more their feminine side, where they also are more caretakers. Women need to develop and maintain that. And then it complements. Otherwise, there is almost artificial separation that brings excessive meditation and exploitation. You know, some of the greatest patronizers of prostitutes are Islamic men, who in their own countries, in their own places, it would be death, to have illicit affairs. And because it's like so extremely rigid, and it just makes them always meditate on opportunity. But when they're out of that situation, and they're just totally into this, they're degraded by it. So, again, balance is very important. When many of the yogis and swamis and gurus from India, who are next to the brahmacharis, when they come to Europe or America, they fall down. Most of them. Because they're just totally unaware of their own energy. And once they get in touch with it, they can't handle it, it's overwhelming. Or there's so much into repression, then it comes out the other way. Homosexuality. Become overly attractive. And so in some situations, immunization kind of helps make you stronger. So some healthy exchange between men and women can allow healthy barriers, healthy boundaries, and also appreciation. Unhealthy separation causes some imbalances. It's like when I first went to prep school, it was all the prep schools, the major prep schools, were all men and all women. And so Harvard, Yale, Princeton, they were all men's schools, Vassar, Iraq, a few others, and they were all women's schools. Can you imagine how crazy that was? So we're all men during the week. And the weekend comes, you just bust all women in. Huh? Women from the women's schools, they're all women all during the week. And then the weekend comes, and they just get on the bus, get on the planes, and just dash into the all men's schools. Hmm? Or vice versa. And so it was crazy. Because you go all week in such a way. And because in the West also, and then so it was just like excessive then when you were around girls. Then once the school went co-ed, it went co-ed my junior year. And after just probably a few weeks, people got a little more normal. When we were on the campus all the time. It's a big issue. So sometimes so much excessive separation, this causes more meditation or unhealthy to reflection. But then again, if you don't have also standards and etiquette, then anything goes. People just do anything.
I have a question about you said love is about offering the same quality of love you feel for your mate to everyone without sexual component. The question I have is, I don't know if I understand the statement, but does that mean you open up your heart to everyone? And if you do open up your heart, does that mean you can get rid of that?
Yes, see, that's the problem, is that most people don't really reveal themselves to hardly anyone. And that's very important. When you can't trust anybody, then it means things, something that is very valuable to you, important to you, you can't share. A certain needs you have, you can't look forth for someone to be able to automatically be there to assist because you're not even letting them know that you're needing this, or you're pain here, or you're confused here. And we've seen it. We've seen, you know, from time to time, you know, even amongst our leaders, that somebody is loose. And you realize that that person didn't really reveal what was going on to anyone. If they did, they could have got some help from some sectors, you know, from somebody. But they were either too much in pain, too much doubtful, too much fearful, too much ashamed, too much afraid of what someone else may say, and knowing that they're at this level of struggling, and they just didn't get the help. So, if we keep living based on a model of distrust, then we just have more of that. But at the same time, we do have to realize that there are some people in some situations where we can be more revealing, you know, and some not. What we're suggesting here is that one tries to, in their own life, they try to see everyone more as a agent of Krishna. Even though they have to be selective about what they do and share with someone, there should always be some persons in your life who you have that kind of deeper relationship with the hope of trying to have even more and more people who you can have such a relationship with. So even if you can't be that revealing, it should check your own desire and genuine love for that person. So there are times when we too much incorporate the action with the individual or a problem, and we let that problem kind of extend itself, and it clouds, you know, the whole relationship. But there are times when we have to just be honest that we have a problem with a person based on some particular issues, some particular situations. We should be careful not to allow that to cover and determine, you know, the whole relationship. It seems like we're holding grudges and not being as loving or as compassionate or considerate, you know, as we could. Doesn't mean to be foolish. You're foolish, you let people exploit you, abuse you. You haven't helped them, and you surely haven't helped yourself. I'm saying that it means not to let somebody else's maya control you and cause you not to be a loving entity that you can be because of someone else's sickness for their mind. Any other question?
What sort of character or trait does it take to be a successful brahmachari to live the entire life that way? And also, if someone felt like right now they live their life as a brahmachari, how would they go about making sure that would last the rest of their life? And how can you be certain that at the age of 45 I want to turn around and do it?
You can't be fully certain. Because that does happen sometimes. That someone can be pretty on brahmacharya 30, 40 years. And then later in their life, begin to feel excessively lonely, or begin to feel that they want children. Because one, you go through different psychological, spiritual, and also you go through, you know, physiological changes, hormones change, consciousness change. So there's no guarantee that one will still want to be a brahmacharya at that point. But the person is desiring to pursue the, you know, the renounced life, then they have to structure the things around them. We're more careful about diet, more careful about who and how you associate, you know, with people. To be more focused in that, as you're not having certain kind of involvements or relationships, then it has to be filled up with more study and shastra. It has to be filled up with more also comradeship, you know, with other brahmacharis. And you also have to be clear in your mind, are you taking that position because you really want to be brahmachari, or is it a matter of avoiding responsibility? Sometimes someone is not really a brahmachari, but they just don't want the responsibility of having to take care of a wife and children. And so, you know, this is some type of bachelor type person really doesn't embrace the culture of brahmachari, but they're just kind of lazy or just not ready to take responsibility. That kind of person will have more trouble because they'll be more attached to sense gratification, sex life, etc. But they're not ready to be, you know, to be accountable. Yeah, we should always remind ourselves. Not as a matter of running away from something. Somebody has a bad relationship, you know, with the wife and the family. They want to run away now and take some nuts. Or someone doesn't want to enter into partnership, matrimony, because they just don't want to be tied down, you know, to a job. They realize if I have a wife, I gotta have a job, I gotta pay bills, and they got to educate the children, do this, do that. No way.
Does it take that person have to have some sort of feminine qualities in themselves? There's something to talk about. You're saying, to me, as well as having a match, you need to be more of a balanced individual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in a sense that as we become more spiritual, we have a more of a healthier balance between the feminine and masculine aspect of our being. That definitely just happened. You notice how Srila Prabhupada was like so nourishing, you know, so motherly and fatherly. Like at the same time, he was, you know, very like a lion. So he was extremely gentle and very caring and loving to see that everything was okay. So that just happened. As well as women. You find women who are highly spiritual, they'll have also that amazing integration and masculine feminine. That they're very feminine, at the same time, you know, they are discerned and protective and developing.
Is that how good spiritual life can have to be indulged?
It's there, it's all dormant. It's just a matter of, you know, bringing it up. You don't find a real spiritual person, they're just so strict and tough, and they're just so autocratic, and they're just so, you know, masculine. And not any more spiritual. They may be very strict and very tough, and they may be feared by men. But they don't have that also, that very sadly merciful, compassionate, nurturing sound. No, they didn't have it without. No, you know, society kind of dictates somewhat kind of what's masculine and what's feminine in external society. We have some tendency to see any more masculine. That's a big problem. We all get so many different correlations of our genes. So maybe a little more dominant in terms of masculine genes and whatever. And these days there's a lot of chromosomal, peculiarities or irregularities. And that brings sometimes difficulty with a lot of things psychologically, because sometimes someone who's born with more masculine chromosomes than what's considered normal. And even they will be kind of physically attracted even, you know, to other women, you know, more, than men. And so they're kind of like a man trapped in a, you know, in a woman's body. And, you know, all kinds of things of this, like this, you see Kali Yuga. Or there are people who are also born, with both genitals. And then as the doctor decides which, which gender they're going to be. I think up to 10 years ago, doctors didn't even have to talk about this. They just made a decision. And then sometimes they make decisions like that. And the person later, once they reach puberty, they're more feminine, than masculine. But the doctor has chosen that the person will be masculine. And it brings a lot of confusion. So these are kind of rare cases. That's it. But if we just have this certain tendency that makes me a little more masculine than feminine, could you use it in Christian service? Why he likes to be kind of like an organizer, likes to be involved. So make sure he's not involved.
You mentioned this morning in the number 16 that negativity is an outlook on negativity in marriage or not in relationships. It's not in relationship.
So that's why the Vedic system was, so constructed in such a way that one would normally marry and then at 50, take the life of renunciation. So that meant several things. That meant by the time the person was 50 years old, they've already had that experience, they've brought up children. Children are a little bit at the age now where they can, go on with their life, marry or be independent and whatnot. So, for most entities, it's necessary for them to have that experience and to see the ups and downs in the situation, and then to make it healthy by no longer being so idealistic, but being ready to work together. relationship with Krishna. And sometimes the devotees fall apart because there's just too much idolism and this out of sync of the reality that any kind of relationship, what you say, the husband wife, it means you're going to have to do a lot of work. You have two people with different personalities, and different tendencies in different ways. It's work. And when one is thinking that it's going to be so simple and it's going to click, because after the romance leaves a couple of months, in some cases a couple of days, then you have what you have each other. And that's where, you know, so just as it's hard for a person to even join or surrender to kind of surrender to Krishna without a certain amount of intelligence and a certain amount of disgust. That's what the true nature. When he's too fascinated with material success, he has some respect. Usually generally involve himself in what he's doing. In most cases they won't even be thinking of it because they're too enamored by the illusion. So it is a healthy qualification to see some of the illusion and the anxiety and just trying to pursue a normal life as subscribers. But we're discussing about not looking for a partner to run away from the world or to heal it. There are people who find life to be very threatening and salty, and they find themselves to be very lonely. So they're looking for a partner, more or less to kind of create their own world. Like, yes, okay, so life is a mess. Whatever you do, it has its downside to it. So let me somehow just create my own little island, create my own little world by finding this man, this woman. We can just kind of create our own thing. So the hell with everybody else. So, that's an exaggerated case. But in any situation, a person is seeking after a relationship or partner, mainly to get away from service, from duty, from trying to raise consciousness, and that becomes mind. So when you're trying to be a serious devotee, you should definitely look for someone who you feel you can be serious with that person, or they can be serious together in the spiritual life, and that you help, encourage, protect, you know, each other as much as possible.
Do you really have to look for a partner?
Well, I guess my own cloth or something.
We don't know what's going to happen and how they change it.
Yeah, you can say that about anything. But then you can say, well, why should I get involved? Because I don't know what the ultimate outcome will be. But if you have the inclinations for celibacy and for brahmacharya life, it's a whole lot easier. Although every ashram, you know, has its problems. I think the householders having to work every day and take care of mainly mortgages and bonds and school fees and insurance and taxes and you know, but you know, that's necessary. But at the same time, if somebody is sannyasi renowned and they're just in anxiety or they're feeling lonely all the time or they're feeling envious of others, then what is that? We should really consider how can we serve best. And then we make the choice. Mm-hmm. I've done a movement of 30, 71, 72, it was 32 years ago. And brahmacharya just sannyas. But before I could sannyas, I just studied the situation and I thought, how can I best serve? And I said, well, if I marry, I'll probably have 12 children. If I take sannyas, I can maybe have 1,200 disciples. not to that extent, because I was thinking about being a guru. But I just saw that I was an extremist in whatever I did. So I realized, the easier way to go is to not. And I haven't looked back one day, I haven't had one sense of regret. But see, we're all in relationship. Now whether you marry, and you have one or two children, or like sannyasis, or what's this, you know, spiritual masters, you know, senior devotees, they're acting as Shiksha Guru, as Mr. Diksha Guru. And so those people who you're assisting in that way, you know, they're like your children. I have maybe about 1,000 disciples or so. And so you think you're, I guess none of you have children. You do, maybe. Anyone? Has children? Maybe. Okay. So you know what it's like, you know? How many children do you have?
Two of my own and four that I rent.
Okay. So you.
How many children do you have?
So you know what it's like, you know? You're constantly thinking about the welfare, you know, of your children. And you're happy when they're happy, and you're sad when they're going through problems, and you're always in fear about, you know, what may happen or what could happen. Now you magnify that, you know, 500, 1,000, some groups have 2,000, 3,000, you know, cases. It's pretty overwhelming. So no one really gets out of a relationship. It's a matter of what kind of relationship you're going to pursue. So I mean, I've gotten away from having, you know, at least biological children. But then, I mean, children all come over. I mean, they write me, just the people coming over here yesterday. Yesterday, I print out my email notes, I get so much. Probably got to cover myself because most emails are in the movement. So I was offline for just one day. So I had 2 days. The email was down. I had 250 email notes. What is it? The other day I was in DVC meeting and I put out my email. And he says, what is that book? He said, that's just my email from a day and a half. You know. Spent most of my, when I left the upstairs, spent like all my time just answering letters. But some were competent, some were godly. But most, you know, they're just answers, issues, concerns, and problems. So, I got cheated. I thought I was avoiding the two children anyway. But if we are considering, well, our nature is such that we can have a lifestyle where we can focus more on Sadhana and Krishna and be satisfied, you know, then we should definitely go for it. By realizing that Prabhupada explains how some of the forgiveness is a distinct quality in the Sri Brahmins. That is a distinct quality that a sadhu must possess, because we're always going to have some people who disappoint us, who are not up to the mark, and even sometimes have cheated us, and even abused us. Forgiveness is more something that we do for ourselves. And let's go brief to that. And of course, we'll listen to that. See, when you do not forgive, like you're holding some hot stones in your hand, and you're waiting when you can attack that person. But what happens in the process? You burn your own hand. Just waiting, and the person will appear, and you can just give a big knock. You're holding a grudge, and you're holding a kind of consciousness. You're burning yourself. You're hurting your own consciousness. By not forgiving somebody, you're allowing whatever that person did or didn't do, you're allowing it to repeatedly affect you. Somebody has done something, some injustice to you. Somebody has done some harm. Somebody has disappointed you. So while you're not forgiving, you're carrying that person, you know, day after day, letting that thing happen again and again, because it's sort of an integral part, you know, of your consciousness. But not forgiving, then you have to ask yourself, how much do you want that person to suffer before you finally, you know, release them out of your consciousness? Do they have to get ran over by a train? Do they have to get bitten by 50 dogs? Do they have to be cut into different pieces? Then you say, no, I'll forgive you. Get what you deserve. And of course, the devotee is supposed to be compassionate. When you do not forgive, then you are constantly minimizing your own humanity and spirituality. Because you're angry, you're tense, you're disturbed, you will interfere with your ability to give love to someone else. To those who you can give more time, affection, concern, it will not be the same, will not be the same quality, because you're the same person. You shut down some of you because of somebody else's Maya problems, dysfunction. So we do have to be aware. Forgiveness doesn't mean that what somebody did wasn't so bad. Sometimes we don't want to forgive the person because we think, if I forgive this person, it's like what they did wasn't so bad. Or it's like if I forgive them, that I was wrong and they were right. Or if I forgive them, then they will do the same thing again. No, it doesn't mean that. Forgiveness doesn't mean that they did wasn't so bad. It doesn't mean that you were wrong and you're right. It doesn't mean that you let people do something again, what they did. No, it doesn't minimize what happened was bad. But it means that you are not going to let your life be totally or so much dictated by what happened in the past. Be ready to live for now and for the future, and not that you're constantly living in the past with some pain. So you don't have to forget. Sometimes it's important not to forget so that you can be sure that it doesn't happen again. But you do, you do have to forget. If you don't forget, then you are allowing that person to really defeat you, because they have successfully attack you again, again, again. They just keep on doing it by you holding on. Don't know what happened. This is something you have to realize. Some people who have disappointed us or hurt us, often to the degree that they are a disturbance to us, it's to the degree that they are obnoxious within themselves or even paining, within themselves. In some cases, what they did is due to the pain that they're carrying, or due to the best they could do based on the skills and that they had at that particular time. It doesn't mean to ignore it or to accept that it wasn't so bad, but it means that you're ready to not hold the hot coals, you're ready to not hurt yourself in the process. You don't want to see them destroyed before you can finally, be able to forgive them. And you realize that they are bigger than whatever they did, that they're sick. Somebody's sick. You don't deny the fact that they're sick. You still put them in a certain category. The last thing, we forgive because we want to be forgiven also. This is somebody has disappointed us, cheated us, hurt us, abused us. We have also disappointed, hurt, and sometimes even unconsciously hurt someone far beyond our understanding. And we want them, to forgive us. So we should be ready to forgive all of them. This is another area of sort of this kind of course, because a lot of people who have chronic sicknesses is due to not being able to forgive. And they, if they hold it in different ways, it actually brings on a heavy sickness.
What brings in relation to marriage is astrology?
In relationship to how good the astrologer is? In other words, if you have a good, Vaishnava astrologer, can be very sensitive to certain aspects of spirituality and knows the science. They can give some general good evaluations of compatibility, because certain distinct qualities, will appear, will show. So some leaders, they recommend if someone's going to marry, along with other counseling and whatnot, they also recommend that they have a psychological chart. How do they make a decision based on that? so that but telling them a better idea of what they're getting into. Some of the highlights, some of the qualities of yourself and the other person.
Number two, obviously, business arrangements for a contract. Following the business arrangement contract, probably a difference was between following certain aspects and having like demand for a reason or not.
In that, making rats or vows is a part of a healthy, mature life. Commitments, even if a person is spiritual, is a sign, you know, of a healthy person. Someone who's not ready to commit, be accountable, to make vows, to be ready to follow through on the agreements, is really a immature or devious or sensitive type of person. So we're not playing down the importance of vows and commitments and contracts, because it does lock us in, help us to be more clear of what's expected from us and what's expected from the other person. But we're saying, though, it shouldn't be so void of emotion or sentiment, shouldn't be a void of a deeper understanding, that it's just a contract which can be broken easily based on certain type of mitigating into considerations. The contract with escape clause, which means that we agree, but, you know, we can get out of this in a rather easy way. Like what's happening now, you know, the no contest divorce. And there are people now who have unusual marriage contracts. You can have a contract, you know, written up that you and your wife agree that you both can have only two other lovers in your life. And if you have more than two other misiparamours, then it means you have been into promiscuous relationships and fall apart. You can have two other girlfriends, along with the wife, you can have two other boyfriends, and that, but no more. You make all kinds of marriage contracts, you know. Both people agree on, you know, to be honest. And then once it's broken, you go to the divorce court and you say, well, we agreed, we can only have two other problems, but I've been counting, noticing, I mean, I think she got five. So I want out of this relationship. That's kind of crazy. Pretty crazy, isn't it? And you say, okay, I have three mothers and two fathers. Maybe the devotees have quite a hard being tolerant toward you also. You know, being tolerant is not deep enough. You should try to understand, because sometimes being tolerant is a form of arrogance. Say, well, Abu, you know, I'm just going to tolerate you. It means that you are first-class nonsense, but I am very spiritual, and so I'm just going to tolerate your nonsense. I'm going to let you know you are big nonsense. You say, be like me, but I'm going to tolerate you, because one day you'll become like me also. So we shouldn't tolerate, you know, with arrogance or with anger, or should we reinforce, you know, someone else's nonsense or their weakness? Now, how do we deal with that? Is that it's hard? It's harder for people to change if we don't have healthy communication with the person. Harder for people to change. They don't feel that we sufficiently care, we don't sufficiently care about them. If someone really feels you care about them, it's a lot easier for them to hear criticism, constructive criticism, easier for one to, you know, make suggestions, make corrections, because they feel, oh, you know, you really care about me, and so what you're saying is something that's relevant that I should really take, you know, I should accept the feedback. But when we try to give instructions and we don't have much relationship, or we try to give help or some type of correction, but people feel that we don't especially care, or we're just trying to use them, or we're trying to put them into our particular vision, and that's a problem. So all that said and done, we should be strict with ourselves. We should definitely impose in the environment, because what the environment is what we're going to experience. But we should do it as much as possible in a tactful and in a caring way. And so we do have a duty to impact upon each other, and we encourage each other to come up to a higher standard. But we have to kind of be there to help to pull someone who's behind forward and not to push them. There's a difference. If somebody is slow, you try to push them in the back. It's a big agitation, you know. But when you're kind of pulling, you're ahead, and they can see, you can see them, still a little bit of tact, but not quite as much. So we can encourage them from the front, you know, by our own example, and our reminding them of what they should be doing or should be about. When we push them, nobody likes to get pushed from the front. So in facilitating help, we're trying to understand a little better why something has come to this point, not just try to change an action, but understanding why. If you just had a change in action, then many times people feel, you know, that you were, you know, you see imposing. And as you try to understand how something has come to this level, you may come up with the same decision to do the same thing, but it brings greater quality of input as you understand, well, my daddy is like this, is doing this, my mother because of such and such. Not proper behavior, but let me understand this is what has brought us to this point. So let me look from all those variables to see what I can do to be able to help. Try to be more positive yourself, but also try to help to convince that person how being more positive be more beneficial for them. People are basically selfish. And so, if they can really accept that accepting something or changing is going to be better for them, then they might consider. They're more likely to consider. They're thinking that changing is something that you want to see because of what your perception and ideas are going to be the same. Even though there may be somebody who's holding close to you. But you can convince them and show them that this is going to help them to be better about what they want to be about by changing. Then the person has more reason to change. It's not, you know, being duplicitous. It's just being a little bit diplomatic and trying to see that change really takes place. See, to be honest, most people don't change a whole lot. People change when there's trauma, abrupt things happen, when they are in situations where they almost have to change, or they change when they feel that there's some significant benefit for them, and then they'll change. Sometimes you have to show people that there's significant benefit if they do something better for themselves, and they will benefit. Certainly. Then they have more reason to embark upon change. Because changing is not easy. When you have to change, it means you have to give up something that you are sometimes quite attached to, or you've been associated with, that you're identifying with, and it's not easy. It's one of the problems, you know, is that many times we're going with the same paradigm, because the change means that we move out of our comfort zone. we have to almost take on like another identity. Most people don't want to do that. They prefer going on doing the same bad things because at least they have a certain understanding, certain, you know, security with those bad habits. And they're afraid of what could be the alternative, what, you know, the big question of what their experience will happen once they move out of the comfort zone, out of the man of the earth. Let's take a few more questions in this time.
We read in the Metro Instruction about endeavoring with confidence.
Mm-hmm.
How, to what degree should a devotee have confidence in themselves? And is there an overlap between having confidence in themselves and confidence in the process or in Guru? Is it that we have confidence in ourselves to the degree that we're following properly, or how do we understand?
Well, again, low self-esteem. But it's dangerous to have too much confidence in yourself, because Krishna will definitely make you a fool. In other words, Krishna loves to, the devas also, they love to pull the rug with someone who's like too proud. It's the way to give you a little hard love, a little soft hand love. It's a big problem to think that we are the proprietor and the controller. Too much of that is very, very dangerous. We have to be like Rupa Goswami with Ashabandha fear. He's saying how, you know, he doesn't have love for God, he's not qualified, he doesn't have love for things that bring love, so many things. But at the same time, he's not saying, because I don't have all of this, then I should just give up. Commit suicide or something. Because I don't have all of this, then it's a sign that Krishna has favorites and he's looked over me, he hasn't given me, so why should I worship him? He hasn't favored me. But he's seen, saying this, because it's an expression of humility, but he's saying, yes, this may be the case, but I have hope against hope, because I know that even though I may be unqualified, that Krishna can do all kinds of things, even for me, or even with me, that I can be used, or I can be helped, or Krishna's mercy is even greater, you know, than his law, so much is possible. The more pure living entity is, the more the living entity is a puppet for Krishna. So the more that person is genuinely thinking that they are not accountable, I'm sorry, that they're not the doer. And they know that anything that's happening, this is due to Krishna's mercy, Krishna's blessing. Yes. So notice how from Sapra, aside from Trekha, the dwarf of the Kali, the only major thing that increases is everything else that decreases. Longevity, size of the body, intelligence, the degree of spirituality. But what increases as there's more sin and lower evolution is the false ego, the hunker. So even though one is having less and less and less capability for spiritual life, they're thinking that they are more and more. So the Kali Yuga, the person, is in such illusion because they have so much grandiose feeling about themselves, even though they're in a worse, much worse condition, you know, than in other ages. So this ego, false ego, is very dangerous. It's one of the major ways how the enemies, all the enemies of the mind, able to attack us. Because of the platform the false ego establishes. It invites karma, krodha, asaya, lobha. It invites all of these enemies to come in. That you when the cool glasses. Mama was talking about, you know, matrimony in his class, so I'll be cool and maybe someone will choose me at the
I had two questions. The first one kind of follows up from that, because you began saying that too much self-confidence is bad. But I always thought that any self-confidence is bad, because you should have confidence in Krishna.
Well, real self-confidence, you know, is spiritual. It's the real self. If we don't have appreciation of what is possible, if we don't think big, then we'll never experience great achievements externally, internally. We have to be positioning ourselves, realizing Krishna can even use a dog, but a dog, what to say of me? So much is possible. We have that kind of confidence to be used. Confidence to be used in Krishna's service. Confidence where we're thinking that we are, you know, the controller, in that sense, that is great. The confidence that we are ready to be in line for the mercy. And we're determined to get that mercy, but we must have it. That's good. We must have that kind of intensity and greed. I can't live more days without getting more mercy. We have to have that kind of mercy. All we have patience to say.
So if we fail, we can't get things according to your plan. And if we're disappointed, then is that a sign that it was self-confidence rather than Krishna confidence? Because you thought you were in control.
Well, yes and no. When that's failure, we should, generally, we should put it on ourselves. Although we do want to be detached and knowing that we do our best, the results is up to Krishna. But still, when we're in failure, we should think, how could I have been more serious? Or how could I have been more effective? How could I have done this in such a way to be able to make, make a nice offering of the Guru Krishna? We should never, even when we're successful, we should never be complacent. And this is the whole position of being unaffected by happiness or distress. Krishna says how one is really unaffected by happiness or distress. That if we're too glad or elated by some achievement, then it means we're claiming too much of the responsibility for that. And the danger, because the duality is always there in the material world. So the danger is now, we're too enlightened by an achievement, then when we have some setback, then we can go to that other extreme. But when we're accepting, yes. So somehow Krishna arranged this wonderful situation, wonderful experience. We're giving it back to Krishna. And when there is some setback, we realize that there's something for us to learn from this. But Krishna is also still there. He's arranging some growth experience, you know, by this thing that happened. Or he's helping us to be more tolerant, or he's helping us to see that we need to change, you know, something that's going on. So the devotee is not impersonal, not avoiding accountability and responsibility, but at the same time, as we do our best, with intensity, we have to realize final results are up to Krishna. Final, okay. Maybe that's the kind of thing to end on. Because, you know, you do your best as parents, or you do your best as brahmacharis, or renunciates, you do your best in trying to pursue, you know, pursue a partner. And you can get everything that you think is in place. So you go to astrologer, Vaishnava astrologer, he says, wow, 99% good compatibility. And you think, yes. She's the one I've been dreaming about. I know it all along. And still you can have big problems. Possible. Or sometimes it makes you feel rather rough. And then you're both trying to be Krishna conscious. So the Krishna consciousness kicks in, like you get stronger. Or sometimes you both disagree in the relationship. Well, are you the same person I married 3 years ago? You realize, well, we're married, we're in this together, so let's see what's needed for us to go on in our Krishna consciousness. And you decide that you get a job, she gets a job. She does another part of the house, you get another part of the house. And you go on. You know, joyfully, almost. But it is this last point, it is important that ultimately we remind ourselves all of these relationships, whether we are renounced or whether we are in partnership, they're all for us to fix what has to be fixed before we go back to Krishna. Because we're all Krishnas. And in the spiritual world, it's not that everybody is just waiting for Krishna and that's all they do. So they have a life. It's all centered around Krishna, but there's so much love amongst each other. And there's so many variegated ways of how to do all kinds of services. And each person is having certain qualities of Krishna. So it's more in the mood of that you're always associating with Krishna in our original Musi Swarup, with others who are part and parcel of Krishna, void of ego, void of confusion, void of stagnation. Then when Krishna comes, it just adds, icing to the cake or something? That everything is already just perfectly arranged. And then Krishna comes and just makes even perfect situations even more perfect. So therefore, in our own relationships, if we don't reach deeper level of love and selflessness, then that's a disqualification to being able to go back to the spiritual world. We can't go back to the spiritual world having so much of the consciousness of material beings. We can't go back to the spiritual world having so much of the aspirations of those in the prison house. Then we have to come back to the prison house again. So then when we hear the statement that there's no love in the material world, we realize that we don't want to park here. We are visitors. And that there's all the ultimate adventures and excitement and romance that we ultimately want. It's in the spiritual world. And even how wonderful a relationship may be in any kind of bonding, that you always feel that it should be better. You'll always be alone. And that's fear, because if you could be fully satisfied in material bodies, material relationships, there'd be no reason, you know, to go to the spiritual world or to go beyond, you know, just the physicality. So we use these bodies and senses, other than the Krishna, and then it becomes spiritualized. We look close at what is favorable for our devotional service. And if we genuinely consider what is favorable, you know, then we should act in that way. So we were discussing how so many fall downs and renounced order, so many promiscuous activities, so many meritus have fractured. And it has a lot to do with just minimizing the basic things that we have in the scriptures. Look closer at what is lust and what is love. Look more scrutinizingly at the devotees who are pure and their loving interactions and expressions. And then we have to just be more prayerful, because the mind is so overwhelming, the senses are so overwhelming. Even sometimes we think we're doing right, or we think we're in the right direction, and Maya has somehow tricked us in various ways, or is arranging some type of sabotage. Because we are sufficiently caring, compassionate, humble, then Krishna will do the rest. He's promised. If we surrender, he will in fact reward accordingly. That's the beauty. So don't allow anybody to make you think, and don't think yourself. Krishna consciousness is just a matter of just dry rules and regulations and suffering and austerities. And no. It is about the greatest sense gratification as our senses become genuinely astute and toward Harishikesh, toward Krishna, as they become purified. And it's about an eternal festival. It's about eternal romance. You don't never get tired. And you never get bored. And you never die. It's confounded to the Siddhupadki.
He's always expected to teach the Swami Maharaj Ki.
Okay, so the past